This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Warfare is a practice that knows few rules, but until recently, one code was almost universally honored. Children could not be used as soldiers. Today, there are as many as 300,000 child soldiers in combat, and you can find them on almost every continent. Political groups who recruit minors often regard them as cheap and efficient means of sustaining their ranks. The United Nations has submitted a report to the Security Council that lists 54 rebel groups and nations that use children, some as young as 7 and 8 years old, to fight in military conflicts. The UN says the report goes beyond the rhetorical wrist-slapping, and it promises to exact significant punishments on offending groups, measures that include travel bans and amnesty restrictions for leaders who recruit children. In a few minutes, we'll talk with the Undersecretary General of the United Nations, Olara Otunnu, about child soldiers and about the UN provisions to try to curb them. We also want to hear from you. Give us a call with your questions. If you've had any experience with this, we want to hear your story. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. To give us some background on child soldiers, we turn to P.W. Singer, a senior fellow at Brookings Institution and author of the book, Children at War. He's with us from a studio at Brookings Institution here in D.C. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How widespread is this problem?
The issue of child soldiers is a lot bigger than I think most people realize. There's more than 300,000 children out there serving as soldiers right now, another estimated 500,000 that are in armed forces not at war. To crunch the numbers a different way, child soldiers serve in almost 75% of the world's conflicts and 40% of the armed groups out there, everything from militaries to rebel groups, you name it. Children serve in 40% of these. Kids under the age of 12 serve in 20% of these. And the result is that they're global. It's on every single continent but Antarctica, and it's in every single area where U.S. forces have deployed.
I have to confess, I was surprised when I read your book to know that this had not been common practice, you know, from ancient times. It strikes me that the idea that you would not use children is a somewhat modern idea. But you say that this was never the case.
That's the way it is. And really the last 4,000 years of recorded human warfare, the rule was once that children didn't have a place in war, either as targets or as participants. And now the rule is almost that no war is complete without them. And to play this out, children do appear within history, but it's always as mere footnotes and isolated instances. For example, in our Civil War, there was one battle, the Battle of Newmarket in 1864, where the Confederacy used a unit of 247 cadets from VMI to fight in that one battle. No one rushed out to copy it. It was isolated, and certainly you couldn't say that the Confederacy was dependent on that. What you're seeing now, though, is this rise of mass numbers as a global practice and groups that wouldn't exist without children. They wouldn't be fighting forces otherwise. And the same thing in the human costs of war. In the last decade, more than 2 million children have been killed within warfare or have been killed because of wars.
Not always as combatants, though.
But exactly, and yeah. From things that spring out from it, disease, et cetera.
So what has what accounts for the change? Why has it changed, and when did we see this change?
It really started a couple decades ago, and there's three things that came together. The first is, while we're living in this period of prosperity, probably the most prosperous generation in human history, we're leaving many kids behind, and all the global ills fall hardest on children. There's more than 250 million homeless kids out there. There's another 25 million kids who are refugees. There's special at-risk groups like orphans, and global disease is increasing this number. As many as 43 million kids will lose either one or both of their parents to AIDS in the next 5 years. And so this creates a larger cohort of potential combatants. But the big key is the next force, which is technology, how the warfare's technology is changing. Basically, weapons now are lighter. They're child portable. They used to describe them as man portable, but they're lighter because of plastics. They're easier to learn how to use. A 10-year-old will tell you that they can learn how to use an AK-47 in just under 30 minutes. They're proliferating. There's more than 550 million of these weapons out there, one for every 12 human beings. And then finally, they're far more lethal. That 10-year-old has the firepower that a regiment during the Civil War used to have. And then it's finally the context of war is different. We live in the era of failed states and conflict entrepreneurs and the morphing of civilians and warriors. And, you know, the best case example of this is the story of Charles Taylor in Liberia, who was an escaped convict from a minimum security prison in Massachusetts. He went back home to Liberia, where he was from. He invaded the country, so to speak, even though he only had about 100 adult followers on Christmas Eve. The country didn't even know they'd been invaded by this guy, but pretty soon he builds out his force to the thousands by recruiting kids, by abducting them, and also by tricking them to join, making these promises that they would get a Mercedes-Benz if they joined his army.
I'll just finish it up here
in terms of this. Pretty soon, this guy was pulling in $300 million a year in the illegal timber trade, including with Western corporations. And a couple years later, he became president of the country. So by using child soldiers, he became a king. And you can see why others would then want to copy this practice.
You began to talk about some of the recruiting methods. Are these kids sort of talked into it? Are they forced into it, some combination?
It happens in both ways. Some kids are targeted for abduction. And you see groups that go after orphanages. They target boarding schools. You see this in northern Uganda, but also in South Asia and Latin America as well. But then a lot of kids join of their own volition. And we have to remember, though, we're talking about someone who's not at the age that we consider mature enough to make other kinds of decisions. So it's not defensible that they actually volunteer.
Well, the other thing you point out is how vulnerable they are because of the growing situation, poverty and health conditions around the world. They're extremely vulnerable.
Exactly. You have to say, why are they doing it? And it's almost always desperation and someone else trying to take advantage of that desperation. And so it may be that the group offers food to a kid who's a street kid. It may be protection to an orphan. But then you also see groups create these institutions to pull kids in. For example, Hamas in Palestine even runs its own schools all the way down to the kindergarten level. And when you go to these schools, the walls, the posters on them, you know, extol becoming a martyr. In Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers, very sophisticated program. They create computerized databases to let them know which districts have more kids than others. And then they do things like they even build their own playgrounds there, except the playgrounds are designed to pull kids into war. For example, on the seesaws of them, the handles are AK-47 handles. So at the end of the day, these groups are deliberately pulling kids into war. It's not just some kind of evil that bubbled up from the earth. It's a well-planned out strategy. And the only way we're going to end it is to defeat this strategy, to take away the advantages that these leaders have seen so far.
But is it more common among insurgents, that is, those are not who don't have a state base, or are states also guilty of this?
It is more common among insurgent groups, but states also do it. And it's important to look at the examples. They cross from groups like the RUF in Sierra Leone, which was this rebel group that basically sort of pillaged its way in search of dominating diamond mines, to in Iraq. Saddam Hussein's regime had a very sophisticated program. They called it the Ashbal Saddam, Saddam's Lion Cubs, which basically pulled in young boys between the ages of 10 to 15 and trained them in how to use light weapons, how to use AK-47s, rocket propelled grenades, etc., and also gave them a pretty heady dose of political indoctrination. Right. And the result is that now we're seeing the legacy of that in Iraq, where during the invasion, our troops fought Iraqi child soldiers in at least three different cities. But now during the insurgency, it's really taken off. Perhaps the best indicator of it was the very same week that President Bush made his mission accomplished speech on the aircraft carrier. An Iraqi 12-year-old boy shot at U.S. Marines in the city of Mosul, and then it's taken off. And in the fighting in Najaf and the fighting in Fallujah, both those very intense fightings, there was young boys to the age range of 12. And the Marines there talked about how difficult it was. One of the Marines talked about the challenges of having to fight, quote, children armed with assault rifles. This is something that just isn't happening in places that we don't care about. It's something our troops are wrestling with every day. You know, another little known fact is that the very first U.S. combat casualty in the war on terrorism, the very first soldier killed, was a Green Beret sergeant who was killed in Afghanistan by a 14-year-old sniper.
800-989-8255 is the number to call if you want to join my guest, P.W. Singer, author of the book Children at War. Lance is on the line from Boston. Hello, Lance.
Hello?
Hello, Lance. You have a question for us?
Yeah, my question is, what the United Nations doing about this, or the, America is doing about this? Because my younger brother was involved in a child soldier. He was captured when he was 12.
Where was this?
Sierra Leone.
Uh-huh.
The RUF, they captured him during the raid. They captured him, then he was with for 3 years.
And did he survive?
He survived because we had to pay mercenary about $10,000 to rescue him.
All right. Well, let me get a response. Thank you for the call, Lance. It does raise the question, what can be done, particularly when you're dealing with insurgents? How does the UN deal with that?
Unfortunately, while this practice has grown over the last decade, our policies just haven't kept up with it. And you got to break it down into each of its stages in terms of how do we prevent it, how do we deter it, also how do we deal with it during war, and then how do we break the cycle afterwards? How do we turn child soldiers back into children? And at each of those, we're just not doing enough. On the prevention side, what we've had is a strategy of naming and shaming, identifying child soldier group leaders and saying, shame on you for doing this. You should stop. Don't you know it's against the law? But we haven't taken that next step, actually enforcing these laws and creating punishments. And so really it's been akin to trying to shame the shameless. And the result is it hasn't been all that successful. We also haven't done enough with the underlying causes that pull kids into these wars. You know, in this day and age when we talk about whether we're a stingy nation or not, these issues, we don't just give aid because we care. We need to give it to head off future conflicts.
Well, we're going to hear from the United Nations and find out what's in that report and at least what they plan to do as our conversation continues. Taking a short break here, but we will talk with the United Nations Under Secretary General and continue our conversation with P.W. Singer about the issue of children at war. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org or call us at 800-989-8255. To join the conversation, I'm Frank Stasio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Talking this hour about military groups and nations that force children as young as 11 years old, sometimes 7 and 8 years old, to fight in wars. With us, P.W. Singer, author of the new book titled Children at War. And you're invited to join our conversation. You can call us at 800-989-TALK. Send us an email at totn@npr.org. And as we said a few moments ago, the United Nations has issued a report that offers recommendations on how to decrease the use of children at war. And to tell us more about that report, we are joined by Olara Otunnu, the Undersecretary General of the United Nations and UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict. He's joining us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Welcome, Mr. Undersecretary.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon.
Give us a sense of what's in your report.
Well, this report is not a routine report. This report marks a turning point in the campaign to end the abuse of children in situations of conflict. Why? First, because the report, for the first time, has a very comprehensive naming and shaming section, which names all offending parties. It names them in respect of all grave abuses, not just child soldiering, but also killing and maiming and rape and abduction. And it names them in all situations, whether civil war, international conflict, whether they are being discussed in the Security Council or not in the Security Council. And then secondly, the report calls for sanctions measures to be taken, what Mr. Singer was talking about. How do we go from words, declarations, conventions, if you like, standards? How do we move from standards to action? From, if you like, a condemnation to actually holding these groups accountable. And finally...
Well, let me stop you there. Well, I'd like to know, and I want to get to that third point very definitely, but right there, how will you ensure that these are carried out?
We are proposing to have a committee of the Security Council set up devoted to the purpose of applying these measures against the offending parties.
What are some of these measures?
Among the measures which are being proposed with respect to the leaders of the groups would be ban on travel. Mm-hmm. It would be attaching their financial assets abroad. It would be banning them from participating in government structures in the future, and also excluding them from the prospect of amnesty provisions in peace agreements. And then with regard to the groups themselves, not just the leaders, but the armed groups themselves, to control the flow of arms, stop the flow of arms to them. Most of these groups, as you know, don't manufacture arms. They get them from outside. To do everything to bring to a halt the illicit trade in natural resources, especially gold, timber, diamond, coltan, which fuels the war effort and makes it possible for them to aggress children in this way. And then to also make it very difficult for them to circulate politically and to be part of the international dialogue. So there are very specific measures which are being proposed.
They sound specific. Peter Singer, do you think they go far enough, in your opinion?
I think it's a very great start, but it doesn't go far enough yet, given the magnitude of this problem. And I really thought there's a quote from a former child soldier in the book that encapsulates it. This is from a 13-year-old who had fought in West Africa. And this is what he said, quote, "It's a good start to write documents and stuff, but it's time to stop theorizing and start doing work to end this." And so when we're looking at this, it isn't just enough to do travel bans or trying to deal with amnesty agreements or building up new laws. We've actually got to start actually prosecuting people, actually indicting leaders, pointing out that they are criminals, not just in terms of UN bodies, but actually having courts go after these fellows. The second part is we have to acknowledge that there are going to be situations where we can't reach these guys. They may be out in the jungle. We don't have our hands on them at that time. So then we have to go after the enablers of this practice. In a sense, it's the parallel to how we went after the apartheid regime in South Africa. We didn't just go after the government itself that was committing those crimes. We also went after the corporations that were trading with it, that was helping it to thrive. And it's the same thing with a lot of these warlord leaders. They're engaged not just in trade and blood diamonds, but things like, for example, the timber trade, including trade to Western corporations. So it's got to be far more comprehensive. And then finally, it's the locales of this can't just be at the UN level. It's also got to take place at the state level. And this is something that the U.S. government, unfortunately, has been behind the mark on it. And this is in dealing with things, not only recognizes the problem, but also in dealing with some of our investment in the underlying causes. For example, we've not done enough in preventing the illegal trade in light weapons to terrorist groups and warlords. When it was time to try and stop that, we lobbied against the treaty along with our two unlikely allies of Communist China and Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
Well, let me talk about that.
Can I just sort of say something about that, please?
Sure, Mr. Atunu.
Well, you see, I'm in agreement with Mr. Singer. There's no silver bullet, no single action that would end the abominations we are talking about. We've got to bring together a critical combination, a critical mass of various actions in a concerted way. I mentioned just one, which is within the province of the Security Council, sanctions measures. But we also discuss in the report how to go to the root, the social, economic, political root. Some children go to war because of ideological attraction. Some of them are mobilized politically for religious or other reasons. Others go to war because there's no alternative. We've got to tackle those root causes. And in terms of the actors, again, the report goes into great detail, what we call destinations for action. In other words, the decision-making bodies who, once they have got reliable information, should then take necessary action.
Are you talking about the United Nations making an effort to go after those who are
recruiting? It's more than the United Nations. Certainly, we're talking about the Security Council within the United Nations. We're talking about the International Criminal Court, and therefore the prosecution of the leaders of this group, because what they are committing constitute war crimes. We are talking about national governments, and we list the specific actions that should be taken at the national level by national authorities where they exist. And we speak about regional groups, the neighborhood, whether it is West Africa, it is the Great Lakes, it is the Balkans. There are things that can be done within the neighborhood. And certainly we talk about the illicit trade in natural resources and what should be done to end the illicit trade in natural resources. So it's a number of actions, concerted, carefully thought through. It is the concerted nature of this that will produce a compliance regime. There's no single silver bullet.
Peter, what about the possibility here contained in the UN suggestion that those who are named can't participate in any government? So if you're leading an insurgency, then it strikes me that once your name is on the list, you realize you're out of government, even if your side wins. Does that help, Peter?
And that is very important. Very important for the leaders of this group.
Sure.
And for that, we need to mobilize national public opinion as well as the public opinion within the sub-region where they're involved, because the neighboring countries often are very much involved, positively or negatively. We need to make them part of the solution of the problem.
It is an issue here, but I think it's important to note that we have to execute on these things. When we identify someone as a criminal, we have to treat them as a criminal and not continue to engage in dialogue and recognize them as legitimate actors. These are, at the end of the day, child abusers. And unfortunately, both state governments and the United Nations continue to engage with these criminals, with these child abusers. And for example, groups in Angola, Sudan, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Afghanistan, Philippines, Rwanda, and Sri Lanka have met multiple times with the UN. They promised to stop using child soldiers, and then they break their promise, and then the UN goes back and meets with them again continually, and we just keep being lied to again and again. For example, in Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers there, it's been 3 years since they promised to stop using children, and there's been more than 1,600 cases of children that they've abducted or recruited into their army, including now, most recently, they've done it, they've targeted tsunami orphans, kids whose parents were killed by the tsunami.
Let's get a
and
response
yet we continue to
that.
Treat these guys as if they're okay to continue meeting with
Mr.
us.
Mr. Atuna, would you agree that there has been this cycle in the past, and is there anything in this report that suggests a change?
You need to talk to all the parties to conflict whose action have impact on children, including the offending parties. First, to challenge them with regard to their responsibility for the protection of children. And there are some of them that will react to international pressure and begin to take measures. And we've got examples in the report of actions which have been taken.
Yeah, give
but
me one.
Engaging in dialogue with them does not preclude prosecution in a court at the national level or the International Criminal Court. We've seen this in the case of Sierra Leone. We engage in dialogue with the RUF at a particular moment to end the conflict and to have them release children, which they did from their ranks. But it did not preclude the prosecution of RUF leaders when the moment was ripe and when they could be actually apprehended and taken before the tribunals.
I'd like to go to the phones now and let some of our callers enjoy and engage in the conversation. Charles is on the line from Portland. Hi, Charles.
How are you doing today?
Good. You have a question for us?
I do. Specifically to Mr. Atuna, regarding the U.S.'s involvement in this program, and if he can elaborate on steps that the U.S. is taking to see that they're not involved with either guerrilla activities that are using child soldiers or formal soldiers that are being used, because it's been my experience personally in the past in Central America that America had no problem addressing, American soldiers had no problem addressing foreign soldiers that were well underage as partners in war.
Were you in the military?
I was in the United States Marine Corps.
And you're saying that the U.S. military works with, if it needs to, people who are already recruiting child soldiers? That's what you're saying.
That is correct.
Mr. Atuna, is this something that the UN is addressing? Is it something the UN has found and is addressing?
Well, first of all, I think with regard to the responsibility of the U.S., which was, I think, the first part of the question, with regard to the U.S. Army itself, the standard which is being applied internationally, because there's a convention on this, is that no person below the age of 18 should become a soldier. No person below the age of 18 should be sent to participate in warfare. And the U.S., since signing and ratifying the optional protocol, as it is called, has been observing this. For example, we do not have any reports of U.S. troops in Iraq being any persons below the age of 18. Secondly, the United States has got a report on human rights that it issues annually, reviewing human rights situation around the globe. We would very much like that report in part to become part of international pressure against groups which are using children and abusing them. And then, of course, in terms of the apprehension of some of the leaders, as we were discussing earlier, the U.S. is active in various places where it can be helpful in the actual apprehension of the leaders so they can be taken to tribunals. And the U.S. should definitely use its influence with the countries, with various political groups, to make it clear that any person who is abusing children, committing rape, and using children as child soldiers, it cannot be business as usual. And nobody can ignore that message on the part of the United States.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We are talking about Children at War this hour. That is the title of a book written by one of my guests, P.W. Singer, from Brookings Institution. We're also talking with Olara Otunnu from the United Nations about a new U.N. report that is making an effort to do something to stop the spread of the use of children at war. Peter Singer, what has been the U.S. role in this? Do you think the U.S. has done enough to stop this?
No, I don't think we've done enough. And it's not out of malice. It's just we haven't recognized the scope of this problem, how big it is. And also, we haven't yet made the connections to why it matters to the U.S. And it's only now, as our soldiers are wrestling with it in the field, that you're going to start seeing that, because they're the ones dealing with this in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're going to have to wake up to it. And so it goes to, you know, how do we deal with it during the wars in terms of preparing our troops better, making sure that they get the equipment and support that they need, which they're not getting right now. And that's one of the complaints from troops that wrestle with this in Iraq right now. But also after the fact, there's the missing part of this discussion, which is how do we break this cycle? How do we help child soldiers turn back into children? How do we help with rehabilitation, reintegration, etc.? And this is an area where both the UN and the US have been behind it. And there's two examples that I think might illustrate this pretty well. In the peacekeeping operation that went into Sierra Leone, there was more than 15,000 child soldiers. The UN sent in one child psychologist to work with them. On the U.S., in Afghanistan, there was more than 8,000 child soldiers that were fighting for both the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. After we toppled the regime, it was two full years, before we spent one dime on helping demobilize these kids and rehabilitate them and reintegrate them. And so we shouldn't be surprised that these kids were still fighting, because we gave the warlords a free hand for 2 years to tap into that. And the only reason we spent that money was it was really about supporting three kids who'd been held at Guantanamo. Guantanamo, you have Camp X-Ray is the adult facility, and Camp Iguana is the one where under 16-year-olds were held. And that was the only thing that prompted us to start thinking about rehabilitation in Afghanistan, even though our soldiers were wrestling with it every day and still do to today. Most recently, our forces picked up a 12-year-old who was part of a Taliban ambush.
Very briefly, Peter, this does suggest, as you just mentioned, a sort of an ongoing problem. I mean, these are children who have become anesthetized to the brutality of war. Are we losing an entire generation? Are we raising a group of children who won't feel the pain of war? They're ready-made soldiers.
I think you could describe this in a certain way as a lost generation. But we need to remember that these kids are both participants in war but victims at the same time. And they're victims of abuse. And like any other victim of child abuse, It will shape them. It will scar them. It's taking place at a time when you're not just a little adult. It's a period in your life where your whole identity is being formed, where you're building your sense of right and wrong, and it's flipping that on its head. But at the same time as that, just like any other victim of abuse, if they get support, if they get counseling, they can lead happy and healthy lives. And many of the right. kids that the book talks about are heroes in this.
P.W. Singer is senior fellow at Brookings Institution and author of the book Children at War, joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Peter, thank you. Alaro Otunu, unfortunately, I'm afraid we're just out of time. I appreciate your joining us. The Undersecretary for the United Nations and UN Special Representative, thank you very much. We'll be back. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.